Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington.
And I'm Michael Atit, also in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Monday, November 17, 2014. President Kiir meets with the former detainees in Uganda to try to close the gap that existed between Mr. Kiir and senior SPLM detainees.
This meeting was good and cordial, and I would like, therefore, on behalf of the SPLM leadership, to assure our membership, the people of South Sudan, and the entire region, that the SPLM leadership is fully committed to peace, to seeing to it that the suffering of people is brought to an end.
And Abyei residents complain about their share in the oil revenue they were promised in 2005.
The revenues from Abyei oil were distributed, you know, using percentages to various sections. That is the Ngob Dinka 2%, the Masire 2%, Western Kordofan or Southern Kordofan, and South Sudan 42%. And
we'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus.
Well, Michael, thank you for co-hosting the show with me this week.
You're welcome.
But let's first go to the news. South Sudan's ruling SPLM party held a one-day meeting in Uganda this week with former SPLM detainees at the invitation of the Ugandan ruling National Resistance Party. As Philip Aleu reports for VOA from Juba, the meeting was aimed at closing the gap between Mr. Kiir and former detainees accused of attempting to overthrow the government in December last year.
President Salva Kiir, who is also chairman of the SPLM, led members of its political bureau and the National Liberation Council for a one-day meeting organized by Uganda's ruling National Resistance Movement, or NRM Party, in Kampala. Akol Paul Kodit, the youth leader of the SPLM Party, accompanied President Kiir to the Ugandan capital. Kodit says the meeting with former political detainees explored options on how to close the gaps between the party leaders.
This meeting was good and cordial, and I would like, therefore, on behalf of the SPLM leadership, to assure our membership, the people of South Sudan, and the entire region, that the SPLM leadership is fully committed to peace, to seeing to it that the suffering of people is brought to an end and all the war-affected communities are reconciled. We are optimistic and we are hopeful that peace is around the corner.
Kodit declined to reveal exactly what was discussed in Kampala. The 11-month-old conflict started as a power struggle between President Kiir and his former deputy, Riek Machar, over SPLM party leadership. In mid-October, SPLM leaders, including the armed SPLM in opposition, met in Arusha at the invitation of Tanzania's ruling Chama cha Mapinduzi, or CCM party. The Arusha and Kampala meetings were held parallel to the IGAD-mediated peace talks in Ethiopia. Kodit says the Kampala meeting is part of regional efforts to reconcile SPLM leaders in order to reach a permanent peace deal. He says Uganda's NRM party shares a deep history with SPLM.
The NRM and the SPLM have got cordial relationship dated back to our days of liberation struggle. It's a liberation movement, and the SPLM is a liberation movement. And therefore, every comradely organization has a right to initiate an attempt that can address issues of peace in our country.
Kodit says the rebels of the SPLM in opposition were not invited to the meeting. Uganda sent troops to South Sudan at the onset of fighting to back the government of President Kiir. The Uganda People Defense Forces, or UPDF, have remained in the country despite opposition demands for their withdrawal as a precursor to any peace agreement reached with the government. For BOA News, I am Philip Onaleo in Juba.
Officials from the disputed Abyei region have raised concerns over the oil revenue produced from their land, alleging that they have not seen any financial benefit. They say the 2005 agreement called for a 2% allocation for their land, but they said they are not getting any financial funds and they need answers. Jacob Achek has this report from Juba.
Justice Deng Byong, the head of ABA-filed negotiation committee, said seeing oil production begin in the late 1970s on ABA lands, nothing has been given back to the ABA community. That is nothing beside an alleged 10 million pounds, which Deng Byong said is frozen in an ABA administrative account by the Sudanese government.
They are not getting any benefit. They are denied their 2%. Because the ABA protocol provided for the equitable, or I don't know whether it is equitable, but anyway, the revenues from ABA oil were distributed, you know, using percentages to various sections. That is the Ngok Dinka 2%, the Masire 2%. Western Kordofan or Southern Kordofan, and South Sudan 42%, and national government by then 50%.
Deng Byong said officials raised many ABA issues when they visit Khartoum in April this year with President Salva Kiir, and Sudanese government official promised to investigate their complaints.
There are about 10 million pounds which have been frozen in the ABA area administration account, and they are supposed to be released for the people. And our argument is that that percentage is for the indigenous people of ABA, from whose area the oil is being extracted. It doesn't relate to any politics, to any issues of joint administration or whatever.
Deng Byong said ABA people have a right to claim the 2% in oil revenues, which was allocated to them. He said the money is needed to alleviate poverty and reduce the suffering their people are enduring. Doug Powell, who is an engineer working with an oil company in ABA town, said ABA oil is controlled by the National Congress Party in Khartoum. He says the Sudanese government reneged on ABA's 2% oil revenue once officials realized that ABA residents went to become officially affiliated with South Sudan.
I know that ABA, there is oil in ABA. And I know it is controlled by the NCP in Khartoum. Deng Kangok is supposed to take their share from that, according to the CPA. But because the CPA does not end according to what it is agreed. So I think people there in Khartoum, they think that those people from ABA, since they don't accept the Misiri to be the part from ABA, so there is nothing to do the share of petroleum.
Doug said the few ABA infrastructure projects constructed by the Sudanese government using a fund designated in 2009 were totally devastated during 2011 ABA war. But Nyang Dol Dol insists the ABA community did benefit from oil revenue between the end of 2009 until mid-2011.
Agreement called ABA Map Roads was signed, and that is the time the ABA get oil. It was not full, but they get something. And again, reaction came and war took place. Until now, we never get anything.
Some observers are quickly to encounter that ABA has not been completely abandoned. Dinga Ngok Faraman Chief Bulobek Deng Kwal said the ABA area received financial support from the South Sudan government.
Wallahi بالنسبه لي جاس ان احنا هو لما كان في لما نعمل.
As for the issue of fuel, when there was a joint administration, we normally get 2% in the ABA area. But after the 2011 fighting, the fuel ration was withheld. Now the South Sudan government is the one to pay salaries to ABA civil servants, so nothing has been allocated for services and development.
Also, Bulabek said ABA has struggled with serious insecurity for almost 3 years. The government of Sudan began ABA oil production in Kech, which is also known as Dipra, in 1978. A July 2009 ruling by the Hague Paramount Court of Arbitration adjusted ABA borders and put it under the joint administration of the government of Sudan and the government of South Sudan, in accordance with the 2005 Comprehensive Peace Agreement. For BOA News, I'm Jacob Achek in Juba.
A new policy review by the Juba-based Ebony Center for Strategic Studies concludes that South Sudan's budget-making process is far from transparent. The report also finds the government institutions fail to follow appropriate procedures in spending money allocated to them. For VOA News, Charlton Doki has the story from Juba.
James Alich Garang, a senior economist at the Ebony Center, says the problem starts at the beginning when the budget is being formulated.
There has never been budget transparency in South Sudan. Most of the budget process is mostly done through closed doors or done by the institutions that are entrusted to do it, like the Minister of Finance and what have you.
Garang says, aside from the budget-making process falling under shroud of secrecy, spending institutions do not exercise integrity in implementing their budgets. Both South Sudan's Public Finance Management and Accountability Act of 2011 and the Appropriation Act of 2012 state that all government institutions must spend according to their approved budgets. But Garang says most South Sudanese institutions do not adhere to such laws. As a result, he says, some institutions overspend while others tend to underspend.
The budget process in South Sudan has been masked by fiscal indiscipline. If you look at all the reports 205, 206, you would find that some institutions are overspending more than what they were assigned. In 206, we did find that, for example, the Minister of Finance was overspending its budget by 1,900 and something. That means that for every $1 you give to these people, they went ahead and consumed more than what they were legally approved.
Garang says even after Parliament approves the annual budget, the Finance Ministry has a history of providing ample sums of money for certain ministries while ignoring others.
Those institutions that seem to be more vocal, that are more militant, that speak out more and show more muscle in getting theirs, are the ones that normally get. Example are like the Interior and money. But those that are soft in their approach are told, you wait until the year runs out. And when the year runs out, we do the budgeting all over again, and they are told, you have underperformed. The Ministry of Health in particular has been underperforming. If you give them $1, they end up spending 65 cents, and the 40 cents is not spent.
Garang also says even though South Sudanese law gives the audit chamber the right to audit all government institutions, some departments have not been cooperating with the Auditor General's office. He says some government institutions are still reluctant to provide financial statements to the audit chamber when it's required. The policy review also confirms earlier reports from the audit chamber which expressed concern over the government's lack of a registry to record its assets. Garang says such a registry would enable the government to record all its property and include the prices at which such property was bought and sold or turned back over to the government.
Vehicles are purchases for the government, for the ministers and assorted officials. And when they are relieved or sacked, some of them refuse to hand over. In the audit report of 207, Auditor General made a discovery that there was a property that was acquired in Khartoum of about $3.5 million. After today, no one knows who is holding it, who is having it, was it sold, was it given away, is it taken as a private property? No. But if you have an asset registry, this thing could be known.
Repeated calls to the government for reaction to this story went unanswered. For VOA News, I am Charlton Doki in Juba.
U.S. Embassy officials in Juba say they are concerned about an October 19 incident which a vehicle carrying security for an American envoy to South Sudan was shot at by a presidential guard in Juba. According to the U.S. Embassy in South Sudan, U.S. Ambassador Charles Twining was traveling in an official diplomatic convoy when a vehicle in his convoy came under fire by one of the soldiers accompanying the South Sudanese Vice President James Wani Iga. Twining said two bullets hit the car, leaving two large holes, but said no one was hurt due to the bulletproof glass on the vehicle. South Sudan Army spokesman Philip Aguirre confirmed the incident took place, but denied that any shots were fired. He told Sudan Tribune one soldier hit the top of the diplomatic vehicle with the butt of his gun, to force him to give away to the president's convoy. According to the Minister of Information, the presidential guard involved has been arrested and detained for further investigations.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, a closer look at the status of Kenya's security. That story is coming up after this.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
which plays a bigger role in a successful marriage, love or money?
I think love plays a bigger role in marriage because money comes and goes. And in marriage, there's ups and downs. Anything can happen. So if there's love, then that sustains the marriage.
Natural is supposed to be love. But nowadays, nowadays it's changing from love to money because other ladies consider themselves as money magnets. So no money, no attraction.
Though love plays a bigger role, but money is very important in a family because without money, there will be no marriage. Without money, you can't feed your kids. Without money, you can't even rent an apartment for yourself. We need money in life because we are all humans to take care of ourselves and take care of our wives.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus. The United Nations World Food Programme, or WFP, says around 500,000 refugees living in Kakuma and Dadaab Kam in Kenya will receive reduced food rations due to insufficient funding. The WFP hopes this is only a temporary measure. VOA fellow Lucy Pony has more from Washington.
WFP spokesman Steve Taravella says rations were cut by 50% beginning on Saturday. He says the WFP is struggling to raise more than $30 million to cover its refugee operations for the next 6 months.
We simply don't have the resources to continue delivering food the way we have been. We need approximately $38 million to continue providing food to Somali and South Sudanese refugees in the Kakuma and Dadaab refugee camps between now and April. That's an enormous amount. Our donors have responded generously but are really stretched given the other crises going on around the world right now, and we just don't have the resources to continue delivering food the way we know we want to.
Taravella says up to now the WFP has done everything it could to cover critical funding gaps. He says slashing food rations is never an easy thing to do.
It's not a pleasant thing to do. This is truly a last resort. But we see no other way right now to provide food for people other than to reduce the size of rations. I should emphasize this is something we expect and hope will be only temporary.
Taravella says the refugees usually receive a food ration of cereals, vegetable oil, a nutrient-rich maize soya blend, and salt, providing 2,100 calories per person per day, the recommended emergency ratio. But now, we'll only receive half that amount.
Well, it will certainly affect people who depend on those rations now. It will affect them in very serious ways. We expect that many of them will have to skip meals, or eat less than their daily requirements.
Taravella says the situation may be reversible come January when a shipment of food assistance is due to arrive.
We expect a significant contribution in early January, so planning to resume full ration size food deliveries in January. But until then, it's going to be a very difficult period unless other donors can step up and help us make up this shortfall.
Taravella says WFP also provides specialized fortified foods to young children, pregnant women, and nursing mothers to stave off malnutrition. For VOA News, I'm Lucy Pony.
Nigeria's military says it has retaken the town of Chibok from Boko Haram militants who stormed it last week. Earlier this year, the militants snatched more than 200 schoolgirls from the remote town who remained missing 7 months later. Chris Stein has more from the capital, Abuja.
Just days after Boko Haram insurgents overran Nigeria's military and local vigilantes to take the town of Chibok, Army spokesman Brigadier General Olajide Lale said Nigeria's armed forces have retaken the town.
Chibok was recaptured by forces, the Nigerian armed forces of Nigeria, around 6:30 on Saturday evening. That is 18:30 hours Saturday, and by Sunday morning, the town was completely clear of all insurgents.
For months, Boko Haram fighters have been taking territory in Nigeria's northeast, including in Borno State, where Chibok is located. They raided the town earlier this year, kidnapping about 220 schoolgirls in a mass abduction that brought international condemnation on the group. Ayuba Chibok is an elder in Chibok, but wasn't in the town when it was taken. People he's spoken to described running in terror as Boko Haram arrived.
Also, it was very, very tense. They came in number. There were a lot of them who came to Chibok. Some are using motorbike. Some are on these hillock vans with the guns mounted on top of the hillocks. So they were shooting randomly everywhere. But, you know, since Chibok has experienced this attack in the past, so once people hear the sound of one or two vehicles coming, you know, people are always alert. That's what helped them. Most people were able to escape.
Fleeing villagers spent days in the bush before they could reach neighboring towns. Some remain missing and unreachable because most cell phone networks in the area are down. Meanwhile, Ayuba Chibok says militants were torching churches in the town. He fears many people are dead.
Nobody will be able to tell exact number of people that might have been killed or wounded. Them that were there, they were just busy trying to escape to save their life. But I'm sure, as it used to be, this place, Boko Haram State, they used to get someone killed.
General Lalay had no estimates on the number of casualties in the town, but said it did not sustain much damage during the weekend shootout. Separately, a bomb planted in a market in the town of Azare in nearby Bauchi State killed 13 people on Sunday. Chris Stein for VOA News, Abuja.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Here are some of today's news headlines with South Sudan's In Focus editor, Carol Van Dam.
Thanks, Michael. France says one of its citizens is among the Islamic State militants appearing in a video announcing the beheading of American aid worker Abdulrahman Kassig. The Interior Minister of France identified the Frenchman as 22-year-old Maxime Hachard, who left for Syria more than a year ago after a brief stay in Mauritania. The Nebraska Medical Center says the doctor from Sierra Leone it was treating for Ebola has died. The hospital released a statement today saying Martin Salia had passed away as a result of advanced symptoms of the disease. And finally, authorities in Burkina Faso have named former Foreign Minister Michael Kafando as the country's interim president, tasked with leading a return to civilian rule. A committee of politicians, army representatives, and civil and religious leaders announced the selection of Mr. Kafando today, a day after beginning talks to fill the post. The opposition leader described the choice as consensual. And that's a look at some of today's top stories. I'm Carol Van Dam.
Tensions are high in Kenya's coastal city of Mombasa after police stormed two mosques controlled by radical youth. One person was killed and more than 200 young men were arrested in security sweeps in the neighborhood of Majengo. Security officials say they have recovered weapons and grenades. For VOA News, Mohammed Yusuf reports from Nairobi.
In a dawn raid, Kenyan police stormed the Musa and Sakina Mosque when worshippers were performing morning prayers. Security officials say one person was killed in the crackdown at the Musa Mosque. According to Mombasa Police Officer Geoffrey Mayek, the storming of the mosque was prompted by reports that weapons were stored in the mosque and youths were planning terror attacks.
We have been receiving information that there are a number of firearms and grenades which are hidden inside the Sakina Mosque and Musa Mosque. So we planned for an operation last night. The Sakina Mosque recovered three hand grenades and one pistol with six rounds of ammunition. Musa Mosque covered five grenades and some hangers and knives.
Mayek also says they have arrested 251 youths and the investigation is ongoing. Mombasa Deputy County Commissioner Mahmoud Salim has called on the Muslim community to take charge of the two mosques where the previous leaders were all driven out by the youths.
Misikiti ina sheria yake, ina wanakamati, ina wadhamini. Lakini misikiti hiyo miwili ni kama imepoteza mwelekeo.
A mosque has its own rules and laws and it has committee members. But these two mosques have all lost direction. We want the Muslim community to sit down and tell us the way forward. But when we hear people committing crimes, when you are told someone is passing there and has a gun, tell me, how are you going to wait? Security forces first stormed Musa Mosque in February of this year. In that raid, they recovered weapons, knives and video discs and flags, which bore the symbols of Somali militant group Al-Shabaab. Authorities have accused clerics in these two mosques of radicalizing the youths in the run-down neighborhood of Majengo. Security analyst Andrew Franklin tells VOA that Kenya's security agencies repeatedly use the same tactics to crack down on people it perceives to be terrorists, but the problems remain. The
problem continues to come back in much more serious forms, and there seems to be no intelligence going to the police. It just seems to be a situation where you continually round up youths. That plus the extrajudicial killings of so-called radical preachers and imams. There are a whole host of unsolved gun and grenade attacks, and it seems to be just a general groundswell of opinion, of anti-government opinion.
Dozens of Muslim clerics, both radical and moderate, have been killed in the streets of Mombasa over the past few years. Since the death of radical Kenyan cleric Sheikh Abubakar Sharif, also known as Makaburi, the radical youths have lacked a vocal supporter or leader, and much of their activities have gone underground. In the last 6 months, the radical youths have decided not to speak to the media, but to operate in groups to carry out attacks against people they perceive to work with the government in providing information, as well as security forces and moderate clerics. Police say there has been an increase in gun and knife attacks in the streets of Mombasa, targeting innocent people by the radical youths. Earlier this month, Sheikh Salim Bakari Mwarangi, who supported the effort to stamp out radicalism in the restive coastal region, was shot dead by unknown assailants. In June, the chairman of the Council of Imams and Preachers and Sakina Mosque preacher, Sheikh Mohammed Idris, was killed by a known gunman near his home. Mohammed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
That's our show for this Monday. We now leave you with the song Salam Ya Sudan by Victoria Ole. We have been listening to South Sudanese artist Victoria Ole with the song Salam Ya Sudan. I'm Michael Atit in Washington.
And I'm John Tanza, also in Washington. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.